afternoon. So last time, we finished up talking a bit about access control, mentioning a common mistake in trying to enforce access control, giving an example of how this might happen in a set user ID program, of a time to check to time of use, and, well, we have a time check, of check, and the time of check is, you know, occasion where we're asking the question, can the user access this thing? We're checking that. And the time of use is when we're accessing something on behalf of the user. And the bug is that this thing, in our example, it was a file, could be different each time. So in the case of a file, the file could have been moved, or there could have been a symbolic link to find it, so that name now refers to a different file for some reason. And this means that our check here didn't actually check whether the file was legitimate to access. And we saw a feature that POSIX supports to help avoid this kind of issue of temporarily changing user IDs within a set user ID program, that you can have your program running as the special user, typically root, but not necessarily, and then switch back when you're done. Switch back when you went to do something like open a file on behalf of the original user. Then we briefly talked about a different kind of scheme for protecting access to resources. So with access control lists and related schemes, we had this idea that the information on who could access what was kind of just all on the side, that it was like some metadata on the file, or there was some separate table in the system saying these type of processes can access these things. And there's a different strategy called capabilities where, rather than having a program be able to, say, name any file, and then we check, can the program really access that file, we limit what things the program can name by, rather than letting you just specify a file name, you have to like specify a token to get to the file. So in our sort of concrete example, you might have a token for like a directory of files, and that would let you access things in that directory. But if you didn't have a token for a particular directory, well, you just wouldn't have any way of opening things in it, because you couldn't just name something in it without sort of that base token. And these tokens, so one way we could implement them, not the only way, is that they could look kind of like a file descriptor. So a file descriptor, you know, is a way of accessing an open file. And when we have a file descriptor for an open file, we don't check again whether you can access it or not. Like, that check's already been done because you got this token. And we can apply that same concept to a whole bunch of other resources. And this is something that some very different OS designs from Unix have tried to do, especially in sort of the more embedded domain. So after talking a bit about access control, we looked a bit at some basic ideas around system virtual machines. So we mentioned at the very beginning of the semester that we can kind of think of what an OS does when it's running programs as providing this virtual machine that is in some way more convenient than a real machine. And typically, we were talking about what I called a process virtual machine, where we have these system calls and virtual memory and all these sort of more convenient interfaces that don't look like anything the hardware would actually provide. But there's another sort of extreme of that virtual machine, which I called system virtual machines, which are sort of imitating sort of real hardware. And, well, the real hardware might not be imitating the hardware we're actually running on, but it's imitating some real hardware so we can run a guest OS on another OS, because the guest OS, it's going to be coded to run on some hardware. We're going to provide that interface or something very close to it. And a strategy for doing this is, we mentioned, was this idea called trap and emulate. So we're going to need to track some state that the, you know, pretend hardware we're simulating would have for the guest OS. So an example of that is we need to track whether the guest OS thinks it's running in kernel mode, whether the guest OS thinks it has interrupts enabled, and so on. But we're not actually going to run the guest OS on, you know, the on actual hardware. So there's going to be things the guest OS is going to try to do which won't work. And when they don't work, how are they not going to work? Well, they're going to trigger some sort of exception. Like the guest OS is going to try to access memory that would correspond to a device controller, and that's not going to work because that's not going to be in the page table that our virtual machine monitor set up for it. And how can we respond to that? Well, we can emulate what the real hardware would do. So in the case of accessing device memory, we can look at, well, what was the guest OS trying to do with the control register? Let's simulate that. And, you know, you might say, how are we going to get the information to do that? Well, in the worst case, we can interpret the machine code. We can look at the instruction that triggered the exception and figure out what it would do. So, you know, that's a nice generic technique. Obviously, implementing it is pretty complicated because, well, we have to basically have a full machine code parser. And this also comes up for other operations. So, for example, if a system call happens in the guest OS, well, we think of what would the hardware do with the system call, and it would run the guest OS's system call handler. So that's what Intrap and Emulate, the virtual machine monitor, is going to do when a system call happens. So, questions on these things we covered last time? I'm not seeing any. So our main topic for today is going to be exam review. And the way that's going to work is I'm going to take your questions you'd like me to talk about. Get them. So I'll take your questions as we go. So first a question on capabilities. So would a capability have a file descriptor for a directory in a file? So we saw an example of a capability implementation where what they decided to do is implement capabilities by extending file descriptors to support more than regular files. So having file descriptors for directories and file descriptors for other resources like processes. But the capability idea has other designs, so the capabilities might be represented in some way which looks a little different than file descriptors. Like maybe there's like a hash table with each process and you get, you know, a randomly generated string that's your token that is looked up in that hash table. That answer that question, and also things you'd like me to review for exam review. So take things you want me to review for exam review. If you don't have any, we're gonna just finish early. So I'm looking mainly at the chat because that's where I expect to see it. Anything you'd like me to talk about for a final exam review? Three. And what's, if you're asking me to go over a specific question, like on a quiz, can you like briefly tell me what sort of area that's about so I can group these things a little bit? Okay. Barrier Schlux race conditions is very broad. Like, I can try to give an overview of something like that, but it's likely to me, if you ask me sort of broad things like that, that I'm going to not mention the part that is causing you trouble just because, you know, I'm guessing. Addresses. So I guess multi-level page tables. Physical, virtual, and RP, so someone asking about RPC with more than one coordinator. I'm not sure what that's asking about. And if you're asking about XV6's memory scheme, what part? Like how XV6's page tables work? Or what? Okay. Using okay. Oh, and the XV6 file system. Can we be more specific? So XV6 file system, inode-based file systems. And okay, and deadlock prevention by avoiding waiting. Okay. Okay, so that seems like a reasonable set. So format of the exam. So generally similar to quizzes, but there will be a few more open-ended questions. I'm aiming for it being doable in 3 hours, and sort of my metric for that is sort of assuming about 5 minutes per quiz-like multiple choice or short answer. The exam, there's a 24-hour period to complete the exam. This aiming for it doable in 3 hours is about how long it actually is. Topics that might be included in the exam, please refer to the schedule. That is probably your best summary of a few more open-ended questions, sort of. So it's hard to give a sort of precise idea of what things are like because the format obviously needs to be a little different than prior semesters. But if you go to the study materials tab of the website, I would say it's probably broadly similar to things we've asked on prior finals and midterms. But only the spring 2020 had an open book format, open book, open notes format. So for what's on the exam, refer to the schedule. Like, that's sort of probably the best summary of what might be on the exam. If we talked about it in the lecture or had an assignment about it, it could be on the exam. Exam grading, because there are some open-ended questions, it will take some time. Time is not going to be instantaneous. Obviously, I want to get grades in on time. What to memorize? It's open book, open notes. Open notes. But, if you did something on an assignment, something in an assignment, I think that's reasonable to ask about. Other sort of exam format logistics questions. Not seeing any right away. Maybe someone will come in. Okay, so system calls and context switches. So what triggers? So system call is a... So it should be roughly equivalent to 35 multiple choice questions, but obviously I need to do some sort of adjustment for a more open-ended question. So it should be actually less than that, but because there are some of those questions. So, okay, system calls. So system calls, are a process once the OS to do something for it. And the process can't do it itself because, it requires kernel mode for some reason. I guess to say typically, you could use system calls for things where the process could do it itself, but that seems wasteful. And there's going to be some, so the process deliberately runs an instruction that causes the OS trap handler to run. And often this is done as part of a library function. So you writing code for your application might not actually write a call to the thing which makes the system call directly. You might call something like printf, which is going to decide to do that, or something like malloc, which is going to decide to do that. Context switches are the OS changes thread is running on a call. So this can be triggered because the current thread, doesn't have more work right now. No. So why would that happen? E.g., it made a system call that can't return write call to read data that isn't available right now. So, in this example, where if there's data not available right now, the OS can't keep running that thread because can't give the thread data that doesn't exist. available right now, and the system call is supposed to wait until there is data. I should say it's another requirement. Or, for example, you know, the thread asks to exit. You know, if the thread asks to exit, you can't just keep running it. But there could be a bunch of other reasons, but for whatever reason, you know, one reason we'd context switch away from a thread is there's no more work for it to do, you know, we can't keep running it. Another reason is the scheduling policy says that some other thread is better to run. And this depends on the scheduling policy. So like in round robin, we'd say another thread is better to run after this thread is run for its time quantum. In something like a multi-level feedback queue, we'd say another thread is better to run if it's at a higher priority because of how feedback worked, or if the current thread exceeded its time quantum. In something like the completely fair scheduler, we'd say another thread is better to run if it has a lower virtual time, or, you know, that would be sort of our basic decision. So follow-ups on system calls and what trigger system calls and context switches. I guess I should be more specific. The scheduling policy, so e.g. exceeded time quantum would have to be, and this would have to be detected, would probably be detected from a timer interrupt handler. Right, the OS still has to run. So the OS still needs to arrange to run to detect this. Or e.g., you know, a thread became runnable, a sort of higher priority thread is runnable because now as its input came in. And this would probably be detected from the interrupt handler for the device where that input came from. Question, why am I talking about threads and not processes? So XV6, each process had exactly one thread. So exactly one thread. So all context switches were thread and process context switches. So if we have more than one thread per process, then we can context switch from thread A in process one to thread B in process one. Or we can context switch from thread A in process one to thread C in process two. Both of these are both our context switches. The latter is sometimes called a process context switch, since we need to change some more information. That answer questions about, you know, how this relates to processes versus threads. Other questions on system calls and context switches? Then I need to pull up the quiz. So quiz two, question three. Okay, so you said fork. This was about switch. Okay, so let's look at that. So I actually probably should copy this so we have some context later on. So the setup for the question was we had this code. This code here. And I guess I will correct some bugs in this code like so. And question three was when bar one is being printed out. So that is where I've just marked with star, printed out, assuming foo has not yet returned, where might the value of foo's argument A be located? So we think about this. So what happened here is if foo is active, well, when bar one is being printed out, so observation one, if bar one is being printed out, bar was called, bar is currently using the, you know, the, we'll say the active stack frame on the current stack. And observation two, foo's argument A is kept in either some registers when foo is running, or on the stack of foo. And if it's kept in registers when foo is running, when foo stops running, either it's still in those registers, or it's saved elsewhere, saved probably on the stack based on how we expect our calling convention to work. And so that tells us sort of where we originally expected the arguments to be. And so then there's a question of, well, if it was in the registers of foo, where is it now? But if bar is running, so we have a question, how did bar start running? And it looks like foo can't have called bar. So bar must have been run while foo was still active via a call to switch. And what switch would have done, what does switch do? So what did that call to switch do? It saved all the registers of foo, all the registers, you know, of foo on its stack, and it switched to a different stack. So this tells us that, so therefore, the arguments, you know, of foo must be on the stack, you know, that was active when switch was called, and not on the stack that is active now when bar is running. Okay, and I guess, so that this is sort of called a switch do, but here, so I made a little bit of a mess. So my intention in this question is that assuming that one of these, that the call, you know, be a call to switch, but my assumption in the question, what I was aiming for, assuming, so this is assuming it's a call to switch in foo. This is a description of what that did. But there's another possibility some people came up with, which we also accepted. And let's say it's not, it's a call to switch, but in a trap handler. So this means that we may have switched, changed. So then our question is, how did that trap handler, so what happened to foo's stack when that trap handler was started, you know, it wasn't changed because the trap handler used a new stack, a new kernel stack, or I guess didn't use a new kernel stack. Well, it wasn't changed, you know, it was the same stack because foo executed in the kernel. If foo was part of a user mode program, this would not be the case. So the trap handler used the same stack, I should say. And running the trap handler saved the registers of foo. Registers that were previously active in the trap frame, and the trap frame was stored on the same stack. So in either case, so either way of running switch, the argument values are going to be on foo's stack. You know, three possible ways. So one is saved on the stack during, you know, at the start when foo starts. Another is was in a register but saved on the stack when foo called switch. And another is was in a register but saved on the stack when the trap handler started. So a question is, why would the trap handler call switch? So trap handler call switch. Example, if there's a timer interrupt and the process thread running foo has exceeded its time quantum. That questions. So sorry I didn't go through the most straightforward way of explaining this, but questions about this explanation for that quiz question? Barriers, locks, and race conditions. So this seems too vague, so I'm going to give not going to go over the issue you want me to talk about, but I will do my best. So barriers. So barriers are an abstraction that provides a have everyone, sync up with each other operation. So usually our conceptual idea, and sort of the example we had in the life assignment, is we have, you know, multiple threads, and, you know, thread one does step one A, and like thread two does step one, I guess just, I should just make this step one part A, you know, part A, you know, part A, thread two, step one, part B, and thread B to step one, part C. So like we've divided up this step into three parts, and you know, for this to work, parts A through C must be safe the same time. And usually our notion would be that, you know, after we do, say, step one, we do step two in the same kind of way. But, you know, commonly, step two part A is going to require step two part B, step one part A, and step one part B to be done. And this happened, you know, so an example of this was in our life assignment. Life needs cell values from part A and B of the grid to compute next values for part A. And there'd be similar dependencies for A, you know, and I guess it should be explicit, and similar for other parts. And so what we want to do is we want to have, before we move on to this step two, we want everyone to wait for all the step ones to be done. Because what we don't want, you know, well, I'll first like show, so we want to have a barrier, so we want to do barrier wait. And the idea here is that, you know, threads one through three won't finish this until everyone gets here. Just wait till every thread gets here. And, you know, the goal here is that the barrier here prevents this kind, an execution where, like, we have do step one part A, step two part A, where, you know, something where, like, just, you know, we get unlucky and, you know, something like this happens where thread two is a bit slow. You know, so one thread is a bit slow. And I guess sort of maybe a more realistic scenario is that it's like do step one, but, you know, it just takes a while to do it, you know, so it spans over just way too much time. So a lock is an abstraction for ensuring that threads take turns doing something. And the way the sort of the operations are block or acquire, you know, wait until no one else is taking a turn, and unlock, release, let someone else take a turn. And we call, you know, call the I guess we call the idea of, you know, taking turns accessing something mutual exclusion, and we call code that, you know, is done in this with this taking turns restriction a critical section. But sort of the key idea is that given a lock, we have this operation, and we can have multiple locks, you know. So I guess the typical pattern is we have a lock for each resource might be a broad idea, you know, and, you know, if resources A and B have separate locks, one thread can access resource A while another accesses resource B, but no two threads can access resource A or resource B at the same time. Race conditions are when we can have sort of inconsistent wrong behavior because of exactly when threads access shared resource. So most commonly, so sort of our, you know, sort of a classic example is that we're trying to do, you know, say do, you know, balance equals balance plus amount, you know, if we took turns, we consistently get amount added to balance, but when multiple threads do this, we can end up with inconsistent answers depending on exactly how they get scheduled, exactly when the instructions, you know, when the instructions that make up that the operation take effect relative to each other. And a race condition is just a term for any sort of scenario which causes this. So other examples, you know, another example is like if q.empty item equals q.dq, and then do something with the item, you know, if we don't take turns here accessing q, then we could call dq when the queue is empty, if queue not empty, queue is empty because someone else dequeued in between. So this is why, like, all our producer-consumer examples had locking to access the queue, you know, even if we had other mechanisms to ensure we waited the proper amount, like we saw with, or I guess sort of another sort of example is that if we don't take turns accessing the queue, then because if the queue is implemented with an array, the counter, you know, and doesn't take precautions, two threads could dequeue the same item, because both of them look at the counter, get that item, and that would be another example of a race catch. We have this incorrect behavior that's just because we happen to have two threads sort of scheduled, so on. And I guess sort of the intuition you might get from the name is the sort of race part is that if one thread is fast enough, something, you know, different happens. You know, how you can think of how this relates to the name, how the name might remind you of the issue. Okay, so questions on barriers, locks, race conditions generally. Okay, so then deadlock prevention by avoiding waiting. So our classic example of deadlock, we know it's not the only one, is that we like have one thread doing lock A, then lock B, while another thread, tries to do the locks in their reverse order. So this is your sort of one example, sort of simple example of deadlock, not the only example, but a simple example. And what we could do, and sort of the problem here is that, this is going to be waiting and this is going to be waiting. So if instead of lock B, let's say we did lock B locking, let's say we did, I should clearly mark my threads. We did lock A and then lock or throw except lock or throw exception if we can't get a lock right away. Right, B. And then we had the other thread do the same thing. Okay. This doesn't have a deadlock. You might say, wait a moment, so avoids deadlock. So this avoids deadlock. We don't have infinite waiting. This doesn't mean that it makes progress. Right. In this case, I guess I should say throw exception, and unlock. And unlock A. To really avoid deadlock here. So this, we don't have infinite waiting. It doesn't necessarily make progress because we would need to do some extra work, to, make sure that this doesn't happen indefinitely. But it's not indefinitely, this sort of throwing exception case doesn't happen indefinitely. A problem called live lock, which we didn't discuss this semester, but the problem that we can run into here where, if this keeps happening, thread one and two, they'll never actually complete the operation, but at least they're not waiting. They're keeping trying. But since they could never complete it, we call that problem live lock because they're not waiting. They're just retrying. And a question, can't it try to lock or sleep until it gets it? That's what we did in the original scenario, right? In this case, the lock B operation in thread one and the lock A operation in thread two, what they do is they lock, and if they can't lock right away, they sleep until they can get the lock. The issue is that because they're doing that, they're keeping A and B locked, A for thread one, B for thread two, keeping the other from actually ever stopping sleeping. So here, that's not going to happen because, we give up on the whole operation, rather than waiting and sleeping and waiting. But because we give up, this doesn't mean we're necessarily making progress, even though we're not having the deadlock problem of waiting. So this, if we aren't doing this carefully, we might be replacing deadlock with another problem where we don't make progress. But you know, sort of maybe what you probably hope practically, but could hope that eventually the timing will work out. And that's sort of, you know, why you might say that this is probably going to be fine, you know, and could do some extra work to make it more likely to work out. So commonly, some systems that work this way might do something like when they give up, they'll like try again after a random wait to make it unlikely that you'll have two threads sort of synchronizing like this. Other questions on deadlock by not waiting? I guess. Well, so I didn't cover the whole topic. So this is sort of one example. So this is the sort of most straightforward way to avoid waiting. So other examples, other ways that are, you know, not always applicable. Include like not having thread one and thread two share any resources. So like if thread one and thread two don't use A and B, but thread one uses A and B and thread two uses C and D, well, you're not gonna have this issue of waiting for something because, you know, get it right away. And so that's sure. And there's probably some other ways I can think of. You can also can also avoid hold and wait, right? We can, you know, if we only lock one thing, we aren't holding another resource while we wait, even if we wait for that one thing, and that is sufficient to prevent deadlock. So that's not really avoiding waiting, but it's avoiding waiting while you're holding another resource, which is the important part of why waiting can cause deadlock. Okay, so then on devices and memory mapped IO and interrupts. So devices have a device controller typically attached. You want me to, is quiz 8 question 3 on deadlock? Someone wants me to go over? Oh. I have a device controller attached memory bus. When the processor tries to access memory, it sends a message to the memory bus to do the read or write. Typically, the actual memory responds, but the device controllers can do this instead for memory locations chosen for them. And the device controller hardware can be designed to do pretty whatever it wants to respond memory reads and writes. So they're just on the memory bus and do that. So typically, the device controller exposes control registers, which are memory locations that do things like give information about the device's state, allow the OS to ask the device to do something, e.g. transfer data. And device controllers can also expose buffers they control, e.g. a memory location that contains the last key press. And interrupts. So the memory bus gives a way for device controllers to tell the processor, I have something the OS might care about. The processor turns this into an interrupt, which runs the OS's crop handler. And typically, device controllers use this to notify the OS of input it needs to handle, notify the OS that some write it started earlier, some outputting started earlier is done, or, anything else the OS, needs to respond to. And by the OS here, the OS is going to be, typically the device driver component of the OS. So in device drivers, we talked about, we have sort of the, what we call the bottom half. The device driver is what runs in response to accept interrupts. So this deals with cases where the device controller says, hey OS, I have something for you to deal with. So an example would be data for you to send to applications somehow. And then we have the top half, which runs in response to system calls, so deals with application requests to access a device, I guess system calls or similar. So an example is if we're trying to write something to the screen, the device driver for the screen would run, that its top half would handle that writing, and the top half, make communicate with the device. It might store information or read information from data structures set up, used by the bottom half. So an example is that, keyboard, there might be a kernel buffer of keyboard input filled in by bottom half and copied to the application by the top half. So questions on devices and device drivers? Then on multi-level page tables. So the hardware lookup for multi-level page tables is we have a special register, the page table register, contains the physical address of the first page table. The first page table and base register. So the hardware, so given a virtual address X, the hardware will look up index X, bits 0 through K in the, given an n-bit virtual address X, and we'll say bits n through to n minus k in the first page table to get a page table entry. It will check the flags that page table entry. And then, if they're assuming those flex checks, it will look up, it will choose, it will extract the physical page number Y from that page table entry. And then it will look up index X bits N minus K to N minus 2K in the second level page table. Oh, located in physical page Y, and we'll repeat this process, and I guess we'll check the flags of that entry and extract number Z, and we'll repeat this process until we get to lookup index X bits page offset size plus K to page offset in the question, you know, some number level page table located in a physical page found in the same way. So we're going to just keep repeating this process. We'll go to the second, we'll go to the third, and we'll get to some, you know, maximum. So in 32-bit x86, the maximum was 2. So we stopped here, but, you know, so the general process is we get to an arbitrary number of levels, and then we check the flags there, and we'll extract the physical page number, say W from that page table entry. Maybe we'll do A from that page table entry, and access memory at offset X0 to page offset, get 0 to page offset, page offset to 0. Of physical page A, and give that to the program. And here K is the number, K is log base 2 of the number of entries per page table. So in 32-bit x86, as used by XV6, we have, you know, the first lookup is bits, we'll say 31 to, so it's 10 bits, 21 inclusive, where bit 31 is the most significant bit. The second lookup is bits 20 through 12 inclusive. Sorry, I should have said 31 to 20, and 19 through 12 inclusive, or bit inclusive. And the page offset is bits 0 to 11 inclusive. And the second lookup gets the final physical page number. We have two levels. And hopefully, so which addresses are physical? So all physical addresses except for virtual address. And where are the flags stored? We check all the flags. We check the flags in each level. Typically, OSs only do interesting things with the flags at the last level. And this was true in XV6. So I guess we, as you say, the hardware checks the flags in each level. So the questions for our exam will be more similar to this than what we do in CompArc, right? I'm going to ask more about XV6 and virtual memory and like page cache related things than sort of general page table things, but they're not off the table. Then, okay. I see that there was this late ask for quiz 8 question 3. I would like to try to answer to go to these other topics before the end of this lecture time. So I'm going to do that first. So the relationship between using RPC in two-phase and how RPC works in general. So in two-phase, you know, we're running, you know, an RPC server for the workers so we can ask them what their current value is. And for the coordinator, current value is, and so the coordinator can ask them to do things. And for the coordinator, so we can ask, so we, our testing code, I should say, can ask the coordinator to do something. We have a whole bunch of RPC servers. So typically in a sort of commercial idea, we'd set up an RPC server for each service you wanted to access remotely. And that's just going to be very much depend on your application. Note that even though we might not think of the workers as the sort of main server, because we want to ask them what their current value is in the RPC model, we needed to have them be running a server. Okay, so then on the XV6 file system, which I probably should have put earlier to match the rough order of lectures, inode-based file systems in general. So in an inode-based file system, most file metadata is stored in an inode. There's an array of inodes in a dedicated part of the disk. In X6, this was near the beginning of the disk. That doesn't have to be the case. The inode includes pointers to the data for the file, and unlike FAT, we have arrays of pointers in a tree structure for large files. For small files, it's just an array. For large files, we end up with a tree structure because we don't want to make our inode infinitely big. And, directory entries contain a name and the index of an inode. Index equals where in the array is the inode. So this is unlike FAT, where a lot of other metadata is in directory entries. And sort of the advantage of this is that we kind of keep most of the metadata for a file closer to being in one place. Especially because we don't have to look around a lot of places to figure out where a file's data is, especially for small files, which you learn are pretty common. So I'm not sure what whoever asked me to go over sort of XV6 file system or inode-based file systems was looking for me to talk about, but I hope so. Are there other questions about it that didn't go over my quick general explanation? And then a question on two-phase, do worker replies need to be logged by coordinators? So, you know, so when asking, so generally, doesn't need to be logged, is what should we do if we reboot after this happens? If the answer is something that involves knowing that it happened, if we needed to need to know that reply has happened, then yes, we better log it. And what I can say is if we do, so if we don't log it, we have to assume that the reply, you know, that either the replies didn't come, well, we have to ask for the replies again. Again, this might be wasteful, but it's safe, right? It's safe. It's going to produce correct answers, produce consistent answers. You know, so I guess we might have to ask for replies again because, well, because, you know, workers never change their minds. If we do log, we might be able to avoid asking for replies again. And, you know, so this might be more efficient, but, you know, but an optimization over the alternative. Okay, so then quiz 8, question 3. Okay, so that was on page tables here. So Q3 was at saying that we had we were accessing virtual address 0x1234 on XV6 like 32-bit x86 and the question was, where is the second level page table entry for this? And what we would do for this is 0x1234, if we look at its parts, so the bits 31 to 20 are 0, bits 19 to 12 are going to be 1, and the page offset, that's lower bits, is going to be 234. And bit, so this is going to be our index in the first level table. This is going to be our index in the second level table. So for the first level table, we're going to use index 0. This means that we're going to access, so the first level page table entry is at the beginning of the table. And our second level page table entry is the second one in the table. Second because index 1 is after index 0, which is the start. And page table entries were 4 bytes, so this is 4 bytes after the beginning of the table. And we learned in the information for the question, was that the first entry in the first level page table that was relevant to this question had physical page number 0x43. So this was 4 bytes after the beginning. So this implies 4 bytes after the beginning of physical page, I guess I should expect here. And the beginning of PPN x43 is byte address 300, you know, because page pages are 2 to the 12 bytes. And it's an index of a page. But we didn't actually ask for that. We just said 4 bytes after the beginning, which this was the answer. The actual physical, so the physical address, if we asked for it, would have been 0x43004. And I think that runs me out of time. And I'll try to take some questions, but I think I'm out of time. So the exam will be via the quiz system. I think I've posted the placeholder. Yeah. Here. Except that needs to be fixed, obviously. Because you are not going to have that much time. You're going to have 24 hours. So that will be available soon. And we'll have office hours, including on Friday, if you have other questions. So I will sign off here. And I will post these notes, you know, like I would post lecture slides.
Professor, can I ask something about the two-phase assignment?
Yes.
Okay, so I know that how we talked about in class last week about how a lot of times we give like the transactions their own IDs, so like they don't get like confused and messed up if the order ends up weird because they get delayed and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is like I'm passing the test cases that were given for the two-phase assignment, but I feel like I'm not really implementing the ID sort of thing, and I'm wondering if that's like kind of a sign that my code is kind of questionable and I should like retry it.
It's definitely possible the test miss a case, because basically we have to do the way the tests work is we have to say after X message, delay the X message until Y messages after we reboot things or something like that. And if we don't choose the right X and Y, we might not run into a case where you don't like check IDs correctly. Like where it matters that you don't check IDs correctly, I should say. But the ID check doesn't need to be complicated. And there are some ways, if you're like doing certain types of double checking, that there's correct ways of writing code that doesn't use transaction IDs. I've seen a few students run into by accident, but it's not common.
Okay. Well, thank you. I have like some ID implementation in my coordinator, but I thought I might also want some in my worker.
Worker is where it's more important, right? So the big thing with transaction IDs is you don't want the worker to get confused about what the value it's trying to set right now is.
Right.
And it's possible we just don't delay the correct message to like trigger if that's broken. Because we have to choose which messages to delay. It's hard to enumerate all the possibilities.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, cool. Thank you. That helps.
Okay.